Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're listening to the Afterburn Podcast, part two of episode 16 with Chief Warrant Officer Joseph Rosamon.
Which, you know, now, because you're crew four, you got the Black Hawk. Black Hawk's probably crew of four or three, right?
They had three that night, yeah.
So you guys are operating alone and afraid out there. And then obviously you have people who have been stranded for hours, surrounded by fire and smoke, perceived death, if not imminent death. I imagine they want to get off that campground as fast as humanly possible. So now the guys in the back have gotten you guys safely onto the boat launch, but now the next step is getting those people into the helicopter safely, right?
Yeah.
So that they don't get chopped in half.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and that was part of that whole landing plan. I was like, hey, let's move up the boat ramp a little bit, because that puts all of the people more to our 4 or 5 o'clock. That way, it would be unnatural for them to move over to our 12, right? So they're naturally going to go straight towards us, and that's going to take them to like a 45-degree angle to our ramp, which would be perfect, right? So we land. The brakes actually didn't hold, so we had to pick up, reset the brakes, do it again.
Classic.
Yeah, and now also on that slope, so the forward gear are like 45 feet from the tip of the forward blade, which is already low. So that creates this approach angle, right? Kind of like the approach angle on a truck going, trying to hit an obstacle, right? And so we're getting down close to this landing, and the forward blades are only like a couple feet off the ground when the forward gear finally touch, and we're able to start angling back, you know, start pivoting back before the aft gear. So, and I'd been in that position before in Afghanistan, you know, where we're doing stuff that are really close, really close tolerances, you know. And so I kind of knew, kind of felt like that was okay. But we had gotten probably right to where I was about to say, no, we can't land here, when the forward gear touched. So did the landing. People are all out the 4 or 5 o'clock. Flight engineers lower the ramp, and they immediately just start doing their job. They start taking over. There's nobody on the ground as far as law enforcement or firefighters or anything like that. So it's just a bunch of civilians, which is scary in itself, because even military people who work, like infantrymen, right? Anybody who's out there, they know their jobs really well until it gets really loud. And as soon as the engines start, the rotors start, and you start getting noise, man, you lose your mind, because you can't hear, the way you communicate changes. You can't communicate verbally anymore. It's all like hand motions and, you know, trying to do some sort of charade, you know, on what you need people to do. And so now for untrained people to be in that position, it can get really, really dangerous for them. Flight engineers, they went out, walked out towards the people, kind of corralled some people up. There's a few people on the ground that helped take charge. And they said, hey, anybody that's injured, let's prioritize the injured, and let's prioritize children with their mothers and whatnot. And for the most part, everybody complied with that. Everybody worked well out there. There was, especially on that first lift, it wasn't like dropping rice in the middle of some other country where you just get bombarded with people, right?
Right.
And so that worked out well. And so we stayed on the ground for, you know, 15, 20 minutes while they loaded. Did some performance calculations as they told us the numbers of people. So when we were doing our performance calculations, we just estimate people's weight. If it's a combat loaded paratrooper, that dude's 300 pounds with all of his gear. If it's a regular dude with just his backpack on, 200 pounds is what we're going to average people out at. And that's what we used, even though we had children, which are like 80 pounds, but you know, this is America, so there's some people that weigh more than 200. myself.
Be a little conservative, yeah.
So we figured, okay, it's a good swag. It'll be close, right? And that really hinges on how many passengers we have. And we rely on the flight engineers to tell us that. So as they're loading, you know, I remember I'm looking back and I see a family, mother and two kids. Kids were the same age as my kids. I mean, that hit me hard, you know, seeing them there. They were just so scared. So I'm like, all right, can't look back anymore because we need to get out of here too, right? And so they get all done and we get the numbers. They count everybody up today. That's 65 people. Like, okay, I guess we're loaded up. I mean, normal for a Chinook is 30 to 33, right?
That's so wild, yeah.
We did the math, came out with the weight, plugged the weight into the performance computers on board. It spit out a hover power that we a torque for our hover power, and it was below the maximums that we could use. And so we were all right, we're good. Did it before takeoff and took off, no problems. It was heavy, but it wasn't undoable. It wasn't bad, you know. And so then we went out the same way that we came in, through the same valley. The Blackhawk was waiting behind us, and so we kind of came up with a plan as we were sitting there in the LZ. And he's like, "Hey, I'm right behind you. When you come out, you just go left, and then I'll go land right where you were." And so that worked out well.
How far out did you take him? I mean, how long of a flight was it to get him to safety?
So that was the other part. So we get out of the fire area, out of the smoke, and then I'm thinking, you know, I had already made up a plan before we took off to go to this private airstrip and drop them off at the closest safe place as possible. But then we realized that I'm like, "Hey, so what are the injuries like?" And the flight engineers were telling me, "Dude, there's some bad ones back here. We've got about, you know, 24 people that have some sort of injury. Some of these are pretty major burns, second, third degree burns, over 40% of your body or more. There's some people with broken bones. One guy literally crawling up to the aircraft because he had broken both of his ankles while he was running away from the fire." So we kind of made the decision that, all right, these people are going to need a higher level of care than just an ambulance sitting at a private airstrip in the middle of the forest, right? So we just went straight back to Fresno. I was familiar with Fresno. We knew it's a big city. They have a lot of EMS. And basically just thinking, okay, we need to get to a roll two or something like that, you know, to get these people their help. And it was a 19-minute flight when we finally hit direct Fresno, 19 minutes, and we just went as fast as we could. But the important part is that nobody knew we were coming, right? And we were out in the middle of the mountains. And so we got back on with the Cal Fire operations chief that we had talked to earlier in the night. And we're like, "Hey, I need you to coordinate with Fresno and let them know that they've got 65 people. Half a dozen of them have moderate to severe injuries. And we need as many first responders at Fresno Airport as possible." And so he started that coordination. We made that same redundant call to our own operations when we got within radio contact with them. And then we did another redundant call of the same nature with approach control, their ATC, as we were going in. Like, "Hey, seriously, we need everybody there because we're bringing in 65. The Blackhawk's picking up more. I don't know how many more. And there's more people there. So this is going to be quite a night." Yeah. So for any hospital to take, you know, 100 people in the matter of an hour, that's a lot, you know, for them.
Well, and I mean, this ties into obviously everything you guys did that night, awarded the DFC for obviously a lot of heroic actions, but it even comes down to it seems simple, but driving 19 minutes to Fresno versus the private airstrip. Again, I don't know that terrain, but I imagine had you touched down and dropped those people off, that would have been a 12-hour recovery with one or two ambulances like running up the mountain to get these people.
Yeah.
So a drastic difference in driving to, you know, a spot that's just a little bit further away via helicopter, a lot further away via ambulance or car. So things like that come with years of experience. And obviously in the end, meant the difference between life and death for some of those people, I'm sure. And for most of those people, a lot of discomfort and getting to a spot where they can start healing and getting to back to a normal life. So like hats off. Cause again, like it's a very complex problem just flying around in that environment, let alone now dealing with like, you know, hey, you're meant to fly Chinooks, right? But now you're going to be doing some problem solving and thinking outside of the box. And I think that's one of the awesome things about aviation, but incredible stuff. And I know you kind of like just skimmed over, but people really need to, like, as they listen, you understand there's a lot going on there. A lot of variables.
It really just comes down to the situational awareness. Like, we use this term a lot, situational awareness, but what does it really mean? And it could mean just knowing where you are in your little piece of airspace, or it could mean, you know, what's my job? What's my team's job right now? Well, what's the job of the units to the left and right of me? What's the bigger picture? And I think that's, you gain that with more experience, and with, you know, you get some of the air sense stuff just becomes more natural. And so you're able to think about other things that some people wouldn't necessarily think about. It seems like a huge elephant, right? Like, and I talk about how, like, how do you eat an elephant? Well, you eat it one bite at a time.
Yep.
And it really does come down to, like, compartmentalizing. What do I need to do now? And what do I need to do next? And that's really as far as we were able to think, right? Like, okay, what am I doing now? All right, that's handled. What do I got to do? You know, what's coming up next? All right, that becomes the next current problem. And then, okay, what's next? What's next? What's next? And always, like, one step ahead, trying to stay one step ahead as much as possible. And I think that's what really helped everybody kind of get through all that and deal with all these different things that just seem like such a mountain to overcome. And I got to give hats off to the crew as well. Like, this wasn't just me. I mean, I'm the one here talking, but it was each and every one of them filling each other's gaps, right? Like, I wasn't perfect for sure that night. And Brady, he filled in my gaps. He was the coverage there to cross monitor me, and vice versa. There was some experience that I brought to the table he wouldn't have thought of. And there was some experiences that he's had that kind of allowed him to see where I was maybe making a mistake or going down a road that wasn't going to work out. And the flight engineers were doing the same thing. They picked up portions of this mission that we would have not thought, you know.
Definitely a team effort.
Yeah.
You guys ended up going back two more times, right?
Yeah.
That night.
Yeah.
So I imagine similar type herring approaches and pulling people out of there.
Yeah. So the positives. So we ended up approaching from three different directions. So a different direction each time because the winds changed and so the smoke was changing. So each approach or each ingress route was different. But once we got to the lake, we were familiar with the lake, right? And we knew where we were going to land. It was the same landing every single time, more familiar with it. So now there's a lot less unknowns, and we can do it a little bit quicker. And on the second trip, the difference was that we had time. Well, after we dropped off the first round of people, we were getting gas, and the Blackhawk came and dropped off their people, and they needed to get gas. And so I was able to finally do a face-to-face with the other pilot command. And we were able to now, instead of doing this hasty, like, ad hoc type of multi-ship mission, now we were able to actually sit down and brief a little bit. Like, all right, here's the plan. What do you think we should do? Kind of spitball some ideas off of each other. And it ended up where we decided he was going to go first, and I was going to follow him in. Because he would take a lot less time on the ground than I would. So I'd rather wait for 10 minutes while he's loading than have him wait for 45 minutes while I'm loading, right? So we kind of come up with that plan. He had gone initially on the first run, he was following us, but because of the visibility and the smoke, he decided to turn around and he found another way in off from the east. So we were able to brief prior to the second trip. Like, he goes, hey, I came in from the east last time. It was perfectly fine. Went around the column of smoke and it was good. It wasn't near as hairy as the valley, right, that we were kind of married to at the time. So like, okay, cool, we'll follow you in. So we did that. We went around to the east of the fire and came in from the east, found the lake. They landed. We kind of circled around. We checked out a couple more spots. We saw some vehicles on the shoreline, so we checked those out to see if there were people near those other vehicles while they were loading. And then once they were out, then we did the same landing as we did before, and the guys went to work again, loading people. Of course, now everybody who's on the ground or everybody who's anywhere near the area, they had now heard these helicopters come in, two helicopters. Then they had an hour basically to kind of collect and get to this LZ. So we show up, and I'm seeing a lot more people than were there previously, than I saw the first time. Okay, so this is starting to organize a little bit. Flight engineers go to work, they're loading people, and it seems like it's taking a lot more time And so we're asking, hey, so how many people you got? Hold on, we're still loading, still loading. All right, how much longer? And it was just kind of every few minutes or so, we're just sending questions back to see what the status is, right? And it was a really long time. And they were like, we're still loading. Just, we're almost done. We don't have a count for you right now. And I'm thinking like, okay, we'll just wait till they're done. They raise the ramp and we'll have them do a head count real quick before we take off. And it must've been a good 20 minutes, 25 minutes. I was sitting there on the ground, which is a lot, you know, and they're like, okay, we're just about ready to go. We have no idea how many people on board the aircraft. Like, we lost count a long time ago. And so up front, it's kind of like, really? Like, now I have no data for this performance planning type of stuff. And I said, just give me an estimate. And they kind of like look over everybody's heads. This is the picture of everybody packed in, you know, that most everybody saw on social media.
Yep.
Like, they're like, it looks like 75 people or so. We're like, okay, cool. 75, you know, that's about 15,000 pounds. Stick that in. And like, okay, so it's heavier. We have more gas this time because we didn't spend an hour in route time. So we have a little bit more gas. And it's right at our limit. We're like, okay, cool. 15,000 pounds. That sticks us at, you know, about 49,000 pounds, somewhere around there, give or take. Our max gross is 50,000, by the way. And so we're like, okay, this will work. The numbers say we'll be hovering with, you know, 85%. We've got whatever, 100 plus available. Okay, this should be good. So we go to take off. Now Brady's flying this leg, and he takes off. And immediately I noticed that, yeah, we're a lot heavier than what these guys said, or what we estimated, right? A lot heavier. The whole aircraft is shaking. You know, you could feel the blades slap, like they're just coned up. So, because they, what happens if you pick up weight, like those rotors are holding all the weight. So they end up coning up, you know, really bad.
Ugh. Which, these are all terrible things for me to think about.
Yeah. So it's like wings are like wing loading, right? And,
yeah.
And, you know, you start thinking about it aerodynamically. If you, you know, where the rotor system's flat, all that lift's going up. But as soon as they start coning, now some of that upward vector is gone. You have more of an inward vector. It wants to speed up a little bit because you've got this conservation of angular momentum stuff going on, right? There's a lot of drag and whatnot. And, but this, the whole, I don't think I've ever felt the aircraft shake like this before. And it's well above, I mean, we're into like 95%. Torque just to hover this thing because of the angle we were on when the aircraft lifted up off the ground. It was still in this nose high, the boat ramp was a 13 degree nose high slope, and so we were still kind of in this nose high attitude when we picked up off the ground. And so the aircraft immediately started like shifting back or drifting back, and couple that with this really aft CG, it took a lot of like forward cyclic in order to level everything out. And when that happened, we ended up over torquing a little bit, even though the engines were producing, I don't remember what the number was, but let's say it was like 118% that they could produce. Their transmissions are still limited at 100%. Right. And so We ended up pulling 103% for a little bit, and anything above 95%, the system just screams in your ear, torque, 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 you know, and it gets really annoying really fast.
Yeah.
But we were there forever, it seemed like. So we were hovering over the lake, all these people on board, this unknown amount of people. And we're like, hey, we got to accelerate, because in a helicopter, you've got to outrun your own rotor wash. And once you do that, the rotor system becomes more efficient, because now you're operating in clean air rather than dirty air that's moving downward, right? And so we start accelerating. And this is kind of where like that high altitude training came in, because so now we're at maximum power. There's nothing left to pull. And we're kind of level there. And once you start accelerating, now you're using that upward lift vector. You're tilting it forward to accelerate, which means you're going to descend a little bit. So you descend until you get to ETL, or effective translational lift. That's going when you outrun your rotor wash finally. Everything becomes more effective, and then you start climbing, right? So there. So on this level acceleration takeoff, you kind of end up dipping down a little bit and then finally getting out of it, you know, and climbing away. And so I was kind of expecting that. Brady told me afterwards, he goes, dude, I've never been pulling maximum power and descending still when I'm taking off. And so that was kind of a new experience for him, which in that situation, just must have been like eyes this huge, like, what the, am I going to go into the drink? You know, what's going on here? You know, I can only imagine how that felt for him.
Oh, CW5, Rosemont over there just smoking a cigarette. Yeah, just eating, no big deal. This is,
yeah, eating my orange or whatever it is, right? No, it was still a pretty, like, pretty hair. Yeah. Thing. Yeah. Okay, you know, it's one of those moments you're like, all right, you got to sound calm to keep everybody else calm, you know?
Like, this is not fun. I am not having fun now.
Yeah, let's get out of this right now, you know?
The dirty rotor wash thing, that's the same, like, again, for a dumb fixed wing guy, the Bin Laden helicopter, right? Like, the rotor wash going into the compound.
Yeah.
That was the same type of aerodynamic effect, right, that caused it to lose lift and crash inside the compound, yeah, right? So it's the same thing you guys are battling.
And so you imagine if you have a tailwind, which I think those guys ended up with a tailwind, which was kind of caused a little bit of that. So now, let's say you have a 10-knot tailwind. That rotor wash is getting pushed in front of you 10 knots. Now you've got to go 10 knots faster in order to outrun it than you normally would have, right? And so now this period of where you're dipping down, you max power, you're dipping that, it becomes longer, and maybe you don't have the power to do it. You don't have the power to get outside of that rotor wash, which I think is what kind of caused their issue, right?
Yeah, I'm sure there's a multitude, multiple variables that go into it, but everything you've described thus far in the past 5 minutes has sound absolutely terrifying to me. So
we finally take off. We're getting clear. We're actually climbing, which is great. The aircraft's still shaking.
Yeah, that's where you want to be, climbing.
Yeah. And so, I mean, you'll understand this. I mean, to get out of the terrain, you want to climb that, you know, VX or VY, depending on what your thing is, right? And we don't have a published VX or VY in the aircraft or in the helicopter. Some do.
Because you can just hover, right? And just go above the terrain.
Yeah, but that's
I'm kidding.
Yeah, well, you could, but that induced drag is so high on that end of the chart. Like, a lot of drag. And so we have a max rate of climb airspeed, which is basically, it's your VY, right? So that coupled with maximum power applied should give you your best chance. That's where the drag's the minimum. Right. And whatever the difference is between that point of the drag curve and your power available, right, is how well you can climb. So that's like the bottom of the bucket, basically. Right.
Yeah. Okay.
And so that speed was 80 knots at that weight in those conditions was 80 knots. And it ranges between like 68 knots and 82 knots typically based on weight and conditions. So we knew, okay, 80 knots, let's shoot for 80 knots. And Brady, he's not accelerating. He's getting to like 70 knots, and we're only climbing out at like 300 feet per minute, maybe. And he's trying to pull more torque in. I mean, the engines are super hot. We're already in our 10-minute engine temperature limit. And I'm like, dude, we can't pull anymore. You need to get up to 80 knots so that we can actually climb better. And he looks over and he's like, dude, I can't. I can't get to 80 knots because we have another gauge. It's called a cruise guide indicator. And all it does is it measures stress on the rotor systems. It takes the one with the worst amount of stress and sends it to the gauge. And what that is, what that's measuring is the bending forces of the shaft, of the vertical shafts that the rotor systems are on. Because if you ever had one of those like little helicopter toys, you know, you do that and it flies up in the air. If you try to shoot it in a direction, what happens is you've got this blade that's going with the direction of the moving vessel, right? And so you've got this advancing blade and a retreating blade. And so their wind velocities going across them are different, right? And so lift equation, V squared stuff, you've got more lift happening on that advancing blade than you have on the retreating blade, right?
Science
stuff, right? So what happens is you get this dissymmetry of lift. But because of, I'm going to sound like a freaking W5, I know it, but you get this thing called, you know, a phase lag or gyroscopic precession. And so you've got all this lift happening on one side of the rotor system, but it doesn't take effect until 90 degrees later. And so what that ends up happening, it ends up in this thing called blowback, where the rotor system wants to tilt backwards to stop you. And you'll see that on the toy, it'll go forward and then it'll blow back and kind of stop it. And so we overcome that through the blades flapping. They're able to hinge. And so they can change the angle of attack as they're going around the rotor disc, so that it equalizes that the symmetry of lift. But then at a certain point, you have to do that cyclically in the Chinook. In traditional helicopters, you do that cyclically automatically, right? Through pitch changing using the cyclic. But for us, it doesn't happen until like 70 knots, 60, 70 knots. The automatic system will tilt those things forward. And that's all to reduce the stresses on the transmission shaft, basically. You've got this 10-foot shaft that the transmission's here. This, you know, you've got this big long arm where the rotor system is, and it just keeps wanting to push back, and so it starts bending that shaft. And so this indicator measures all that, and that thing was pegged out in the red, and we were only at like 65, 70 knots. I was like, look, man, I can't go any faster. The CGI is in the red already, so we had to slow down. Like, oh yeah, that's more important than this number I have stuck in my head. So we slow down, and we're like at 60 knots, and this thing finally comes down to like middle of the yellow. I'm like, okay, that's a little bit more doable, because the last thing I want is for this rotor system just to fall apart, you know, and come off. So we don't, red bad, yellow better, you know. Yeah. And
and spinning blades of death, I tell you. Yeah,
and we're climbing the whole time, and I'm trying to look for like, okay, when can we make this turn? And next thing you know, we're at 8,000 feet before we, you know, and it's 40 degrees out, so that DA is huge DA number, right? And and we finally were able to make the turn so that we can clear the mountains. And this was 7-8 minutes into this climb, and we're in our 10-minute limit. And so there might have been a couple times where we're like, okay, reduce power real quick. Okay, timer's turned off. Turn the timers right back on again, you know.
What's a reset? Yeah. Well, it's back in limits. Yeah, good to go.
Yeah, nothing says how many times I can be in this limit, you know.
Right.
And so we do that, and we finally get over this ridge line to where we can now start descending. And as we descend, we're starting to be able to pick up more speed. We're down to like 55 knots in this climb. So we're battling this. So, you know, our induced drag is kind of coming up on the backside of this power curve, right? Doing this like slow flight stuff, right? And so we're only climbing like 200-300 feet per minute at a time, which is horribly slow, and still got this max power applied, trying to like balance airspeed versus climb performance. And that was the second time where my feelers kind of went off, kind of like, oh boy, I hope this works out, right? And so that was kind of hair raising for me at that point, thinking, are we going to be able to get over these mountains? Because I really don't want to have to go through that valley again, because now the conditions are worse. But it worked out. The aircraft stayed together. It was wonderful.
That's a good day. Yeah. It stayed together.
We started descending into the Fresno Valley. Performance got better. We were able to go a little bit faster and still stay in the green. Our power available started getting better as we descended, got out of the heat from the fire, right? So the DA was going down pretty significant. And so now we're doing our before landing, right? And so now because we're going so slow, that turned into a 30-minute flight. But and we're burning like 4,000 pounds of gas an hour, which is just a huge amount. And we're doing our before landing. It says performance considerations, check. Oh, well, we don't know. Like, we know what is available, but we don't know how much we weigh. We don't know. We know we took off with this amount of weight, we took off at 3,300 feet. The airport's at 300 feet, probably a little bit cooler. So we know we got better performance, but we really don't know what to expect. So we decide that we were going to attempt to do a roll-on landing. So basically land like an airplane, right? So it allows us to use less power because we don't have to get into towards the zero side of less than 20 knots, right? Our drag curve goes way up. The induced drag is huge, right? And so we can stay in like the lower part of the drag curve, use less power to land, roll it on, and decelerate using aerodynamic braking. Really, really easy. So we're like, okay, yeah, we'll do that. Okay, we start doing the checks to do the roll-on, coordinating with ATC to get the whole runway. And then the flight engineer in the back goes, well, guys, that's going to be a problem. Okay, why is this going to be a problem? And he goes, I have people on the ramp. We can't close the ramp. So the ramp is still level. And if we were to do the roll-on, we'd scrape the ramp the whole way.
Oh, wow.
And like, so you have no room to, you know, push them forward, get the ramp up. Nope, there's no room. they're already back here squished. And apparently they were like, they had like their necks tilted because their head was hitting the ceiling of the cabin and everything. And the guys were telling them like, hey, if you need to hold on to something, hold on here, not there, because that's a hydraulic line or that's a drive shaft, you know, that sort of thing. And so I'm like, okay, we can't do the roll on then. So we opt to just use the runway still. And I briefing Brady on, all right, just keep your speed up at like 60 knots, stay at the bottom of the bucket until we get, you know, within 10 feet of the ground, and it will just slowly decelerate. And that's the next best thing, right? Stay close to the ground where we're still in ground effect, use less power to hover and give ourselves the best chances of making this successful and not rough. Because if people are standing and we have this harder type of landing, not a hard landing, but like a rough landing, we could injure some people again, right? So we do that. It works out fine. We get to the hover, we land, start taxiing in. We notice that even the steering is sluggish, the power steering is sluggish just because of all this weight that's in the aircraft. And I told the guys, like, hey, when we park, I need to get a solid head count. When they start deplaning, count everybody. It took a long time. Like, we shut down completely. We got all of our stuff off, and we're trying to get out of the cockpit, and half the cabin is still full. And the final number came out to 102. And I was just
absolutely
blown away. Like, that's over triple what we normally take. And no wonder we were so heavy, right? And I still don't know how that happened, how we got 102 people on board. It was absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, that's phenomenal. What do you say, like, normal max weight, like 15,000 pounds of cargo?
Yeah, right around 15 or 16 or whatever. Yeah. And so, I mean, just do the math, 102 times 200, you're looking at 20,000 pounds.
Yeah.
Now, of course, like we said before, that's a swag. Some of them are children. Some of them are guys like you and me, right? So,
yeah, I mean, you're going to be plus or minus there a little bit, but still, like, I mean, 102 people, like, that's phenomenal. Obviously, the performance, the Chinook, I mean, speaks for itself.
Yeah.
I know you guys were working it hard, but.
Yeah, and over the coming days, we went through that scenario backwards, and we're like, okay, we figured out, you know, what was our performance? Like, we now that we know the number, what did the chart say? And it was pretty well outside the charts. Like, when we took off, when we took off from Mammoth Pools, we estimate we were at about 52,000 pounds. So about 2,000 pounds over max gross weight for those conditions. Once we had to do the climb to 8,000 feet, we figure we were about 10,000 pounds over gross for those conditions. But some through the engines being, you know, better than standard, through whatever else, like, it worked out. Right. And to give some perspective, is like 52,000 pounds isn't that big. It's over gross for us, but in the special ops community, they operate at 54,000 pounds all the time. So the aircraft can do it structurally. It's just that TBOs go down when you do that and whatnot. So it really came down. I think the worst part was that climb to 8,000. That's where we were really outside of the chart limits and really in like basically test flight mode now, you know.
Yeah, that's incredible. So that night, between you and the Black Hawk crew, again, you guys rescued, was it 242 individuals? Is that what you guys were credited with?
So the number came out to 242, but we had a different number amongst the aircraft. We came out to like 261 or something like that. And the difference there was when they came up with that 242 number, that was everybody that signed in to the triage center there on the guard ramp. But there were 19 people that got taken away by ambulance immediately and never signed in. So when we were like, this is the number I have, this is the number you have, where's the difference? They realized, oh, it's the people that never signed in.
I mean, hats off to you guys. I know you're working really hard. Obviously, it took a lot of guts to go in there. I know no one else was flying. It's nighttime. There's smoke. There's fire. And without you guys doing that, there'd be a lot of people who probably would not be with us today. So
at least a few, I think.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, even Amatorian can walk and move around. I know the ones with burns and things like that, spend the night out in the wilderness is probably not going to lend well to it, even if the fire stayed off. So again, incredible story. I would like to kind of wrap up. We really dove deep down into this mission, which is phenomenal, and people are going to be fascinated by And didn't really get to talk a whole lot about you. One thing I like to do when I wrap up an episode with guests is kind of ask them, hey, if you saw 15-year-old Joe today, is there anything you would say to him to do something different, change something, or would no change and just keep pressing forward?
I would probably tell him, don't buy that timeshare. You know,
sage advice. Yeah.
There's very little that I regret growing up. My parents did an excellent job of keeping me busy to keep me out of trouble, growing up, kept me in the scouts, you know, did the Eagle Scout thing, and once I was done with that, I was in Civil Air Patrol for a while. Through high school, kept me really busy and out of trouble, like you said. And even though, like, my main goal was to go fly jets in the Air Force, right? I really think that I ended up where I needed to be. I was, like I said, right place at the right time is how we started this whole thing, right? Yep. And I was the first W-1 that had come back from flight school to this unit in like 20 years. And so of course got hazed and thought it was the worst thing in the world, you know, but that set me apart from my peer group. So my closest peer group was, you know, a year behind me, in the unit. And, that let me go on this deployment that nobody wanted to go on, but then prove myself enough to get a full-time job, in the Guard. And so I've been here as a federal technician, you know, since 04. And luckily I had some leadership that saw potential. They were kind of worried about me at first, because I was young, 20s, you know, and they're like, man, I hope he matures, but, you know, we'll hire him anyways, because, you know, we think he's got potential. And luckily that all worked out. And now I have this, I live 10 minutes away from where I work. And I'm in a position, over these years, I'm in a position now to do some of these things that we did on the 5th, and can bring the experience to these guys coming in now. And just now the name of the game is just impart this knowledge, right? Like, I guess the only thing that 15-year-old Joe could do is maybe listen a little bit better, you know?
That's probably all of us, probably.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, we've all had plenty of lessons that we've had to learn the hard way, even though we know that there are people out there that tried to teach us, you know,
and, no doubt.
But we're young and headstrong and just try to learn from other people's mistakes, because sometimes when you learn the hard way, it's also the fatal way. Right. And it's through, I think there's been plenty of times where luck has been on my side.
Yep.
For sure.
Same.
For sure.
It always helps learn from those that come before you. But sometimes we have to learn the hard way, and the lucky ones, we make it through without any significant wounds or permanent damage.
I think we all go around, especially in aviation, we go around with, you know, two bags. We have our skill bag and we have our luck bag. And you want to be able to pull from your skill bag a whole lot more than you pull from your luck bag, because one day you're going to reach in and it's going to be empty.
Yep.
You know?
No doubt. It's a good way of looking at it. Well, again, Joe, Chief Warrant, Joseph Rosamon, you and your crew, hats off to you guys, all the recipients of the Distinguished Flying Cross, again, for all the heroic actions you guys did on September 5th and saving 260-plus civilians trapped in the Creek Fire there out in California. So thank you for what you guys do. I appreciate you taking the time and joining me on the podcast today.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for listening in today. I hope you enjoyed today's podcast. Again, wherever you're listening, hit subscribe. And if you can, leave me a rating and review over on iTunes. That definitely helps out. Until next time, don't bring it weak.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
Complete your staining project with Pittsburgh Paints and Stains now at Menards. Stain in one coat with Ultra Advanced Semi-Transparent Stain. It's a stain and sealant in one that can be applied to damp wood and on hot, sunny days, allowing you to clean and stain your deck in one day. Save big money on Pittsburgh Paints and Stains and head into Menards to get your staining project started today. Save big money.